Welcome to the Smart Thinking Podcast. This is my dad, Ted.
Welcome to the Smart Thinking Podcast. I'm your host, Ted Knightsky. What if you had the ability to look into the future in live time? Well, I had that opportunity last week when I spoke to two Australian school administrators and got from them an idea of what's going to happen in the future. You see, in the southern hemisphere of the world, it is the winter season right now, and they are in school, where in the northern hemisphere, many of us are enjoying summer, and we are out of school. So during COVID and all the different things that have been going on the last couple of months, they have been in school in real time and reacting and responding to the needs of their students, parents, and faculty as COVID has struck in different parts of the world. So I was very fortunate to catch up to two administrators from Geelong College, which is a early learning through 12th grade preparatory school in Australia, southwest of Melbourne. And they are Emily Fitzsimmons, who's the director of teaching and learning, and Simon Young, who is the head of senior school. Now, it's a school system of 1,200 students, so it's about the size of an average American school district. And we had a great conversation. Now, this was a Zoom call between us and several school district administrators and principals here in the state of Wisconsin and Michigan, as well as Ohio. But I decided to record it as we were heading through the conversation, because I thought this would be a great podcast for a lot of different people to listen to, regardless of your role in education. Whether you are a parent, a principal, a teacher, a grandparent, a kid, it doesn't matter, because some of the things we learned from our conversation was how they responded, what they did different, how they reacted, what they did when they had to close, and what they did when they were open. This conversation picks up about 2 minutes into our total meeting, and it's right after I ask a question about what was it like when COVID first started. So here we go. Emily and Simon are my guests on the Smart Thinking Podcast.
COVID wasn't really even on the sort of the Australian radar. It had certainly taken off in China. We were starting to hear a little bit about Europe, but when we began our school year, we just had no concept that it was going to do what it has done for all of us as school leaders. So at the very beginning, very little. Simon, would that be accurate?
Yeah, that would be. And even then, we weren't forecasting that we were going to need to go, you know, in the direction that we ended up in. So, Ted, if you like, I'll skip to the part where we then did move. You know, it became real. One of the things we experienced was, as I'm sure you all did too, was just uncertainty. And you know, there was a lot of people thinking, well, it'll blow over. It won't really affect us. And then each phase had got closer to the point where we probably had 6 weeks of school term to begin the year, which was as normal. And then the seventh week and the eighth week became, will we or won't we go into lockdown or remote learning? And that was the most difficult sort of people for us to work with was our staff. I think they were probably the most heightened out of everyone, because the government was saying schools are safe. You can keep schools, there's no transmission in schools. Kids are okay, but the staff just felt like they weren't being thought about at all. So for us, the staff room was probably the hardest thing to negotiate. But when we made the decision, which we did voluntary to begin with, we made a voluntary decision to go to remote learning, that immediately was like a switch, and that immediately gave everyone some comfort. It was amazing the difference in the day before to that day. Everyone had some certainty, right, this is what we're doing, we can move on. So physically, the campus, we had to do lots of things. We've tried to distance. We still, unfortunately, have some industrial sort of looking classrooms where, you know, the exam format of a classroom. So we just made sure all of our rooms were, the desks were distanced as well as we could. Every room, classroom, and hallway or learning space had a hand sanitizing station. But as we know, if there's one thing teenagers don't do well, it's distancing and hygiene. And so we had lots of problems with that and just trying to train the kids to do it properly. But I guess the mantra that we had within was to try and make sure our campus was safe, but more importantly, that it felt safe. So for us, feeling safe was probably the most important thing for us.
How did your administrative team or teachers deal with students who were in violation of those, social distancing, no touching? You know, we've had some things here in the United States where we've had some school-based pieces because we didn't have graduation and we asked kids to give distance. But as soon as 15, 17, 18-year-olds were together, immediately on top of each other, you know, selfieing, how did you guys deal with that? Was there discipline, parents, suspensions? I mean, how did you, and what was the responses of the kids when you did?
We didn't have to go down the punitive line at all. We were fortunate where when the restrictions were imposed upon us at schools, one of the things they said was that, which was nice because it was actually a little bit of common sense, was that in schools that the students didn't have to distance. So it was 1.5 metres was obviously what we were trying to do as a society, but they weren't sort of really imposing hard restrictions on the students, which was good. That helped because it actually helped. As I said, the staff were our heightened ones. The kids were still very blasé about it early on. I don't think it was real for them to begin with. When I was communicating with the students, I just went with a no touching rule. So rather than try and have teachers or staff members with 1.5 metre rulers amongst the students, I just said no touching. So I don't think we necessarily did it as well as we could have, but I think that I was just trying to find the sweet spot between the restrictions and doing the right thing and dealing with teenagers. So that's how we tended to do it. But no, we didn't. There was no suspensions. There was obviously lots of education around it, lots of conversations, but not. Yeah, there was certainly no punitive response.
And Ted, that was the same in the other schools too. I was just going to say that was the same in our kind of pre-K through that year eighth grade. Simon's based here on the senior school campus, but I moved between them, and it was exactly the same in the other campuses. I mean, you can't tell a five-year-old not, you know, stay 1.5 metres from another five-year-old. They don't understand what that means. And our little 3- and 4-year-olds, they just climb all over people and touch and hug and everything else. So it was really taking the government, our health department, our state health department's advice was that children, initially at least, children were not the spreaders of COVID. And so we were getting this kind of rhetoric out of our government that said, look, don't worry too much in schools, children are not the problem. And so that was sort of what we went with. That's changed slightly in the last few weeks, particularly here in Melbourne, where there are some schools that have been closed. And that's why just on Sunday, our state premier, the equivalent of your governor, said, right, everybody's going to remote learning right across the state. So the state of Victoria is now in remote learning as of today, because there were more breakouts in schools. And the other thing they were trying to do was to stop movement, stop people moving, stop people driving to school, taking kids to school, stop kids on school buses, people on public transport. So one of the quickest ways to contain people's movement was to say no school, no one leaves home. And that's why we found ourselves in this second spot now.
And when you had, like, so just backing up a couple of weeks here, if you did have 3 or 4 kids in a classroom show symptoms, was that classroom quarantined? Did those kids get to come to school but stay in that room? How did you handle that?
Simon, can I take that?
Yeah, our communication to all of our parents along the way was, and this was also coming from the health officials, was that if you have any symptoms, then you must not go to work, and that obviously applies to school for students as well. So we were lucky. I think we were pretty good, but where we had, as I said, and I've said this a few times, we had some heightened staff. So one of the best things we did was have the ability to temperature test. So we had a few students who had a couple of coughs a runny nose or a sniffle, and they would be immediately sent to student administration where we would temperature test them. Sometimes they were then sent home and off for a COVID test, and parents were very good at assisting with that. We had one where a boy just had some hay fever symptoms And so he was sent temperature tested. It was checked. He had hay fever symptoms, which were on our medical system. And so he was able to go back to class. So for us, the temperature testing actually helped a great deal. We actually chose not. Some schools over here temperature tested every student on arrival to school. We didn't do that in the senior school. We've got a complicated campus with about 25 different entry points onto the campus, which makes that difficult. I'm exaggerating, it's probably not 25. But we had some, and some students who were coming from a distance were temperature tested by the bus drivers and those sorts of things before they got here. So that's how we dealt with that. But generally, most kids stayed away. I think the other thing that was helpful for us is we had less assessment during that sort of phase. And we found in the past, lots of students will come to school unwell purely to either be prepared for an assessment or to do an assessment. So we were flexible around that where we needed to be.
So one of the things that you've said, you've both said, is the staff. You know, there's always the joke that schools would be great if they were only kids, and then there's a joke that schools would be great if they were only adults, and those different types of pieces. How have you supported the staff's mental well-being? Because as you started out, we all experienced the same thing for us in March, where there was like a heightened level of paranoia. Yeah. Our media is really, you know, shows every night the worst cases across the country, and staff is nervous. What tips do you have for us on supporting teachers and staff and support people in the schools?
Yeah. Well, look, a couple of things that become clear fairly quickly. Our media is exactly the same as yours, so don't worry about that. But there are sort of two categories of staff care to worry about. One is the staff's sort of professional life. That is what they're going to be expected to do at school and whether they're going to be safe at school and how they're going to interact with children and those sorts of things. And then the second one is just their out-of-school life, because, you know, teachers are humans too, and a lot of our staff had, for example, ageing parents in nursing homes, and you may have seen on your news some of the disasters in our nursing homes here in Victoria. Some of them had elderly parents who lived at home, but they were very heightened around that. Some of them had a partner who worked on, you know, in a hospital. So frontline workers were in their immediate family. Some of them had underlying health issues themselves, either mental health or physical health issues that made them quite susceptible at times like this. So we had to try and, first of all, we had to be reasonable and remember that people are human. Our human resources department here did a really good job of finding out who were the people who were struggling, trying to get their feelers out, is the term we sometimes use in Australia, getting their feelers out to get a sense of who was struggling. We ran
Can I just ask, how did they do that? Because it's such an uncomfortable conversation. What were some of their tactics for that?
Yeah, so look, we've got some staff, and you would be the same in your schools. There are some staff who are very quick to send an email when they're feeling uncomfortable.
That never happens here.
Never. Oh, I'm sure it does. So we've got some who are just very communicative people, and they love to tell us how they're feeling at every moment of the week and how they feel after every email that's been sent by management. Or how they feel after every announcement from the health department. So we do get some that are just very communicative, so we know exactly how they're feeling. There are others who, we've got a very supportive school community here, so our line managers, our kind of middle management team who look after some of these staff are very good at knowing how their staff are tracking. And we've just got staff that keep an eye out for colleagues. So we've got, between all of those sort of lines of communication, we develop a pretty good sense of it. And those that have been here a while in leadership know who the people are that are likely to be struggling a little bit. But I think one of the things that some other schools have done, some more structured things around surveys, more staff meetings or focus groups. We tried not to have too many staff meetings in that, bringing people together, because sometimes the sort of the hysteria can breed hysteria. You know, you get a few people in there and they've all got really detailed questions, just all goes a bit nuts. So we tried to avoid too many bringing people together, but we had lots of things on Microsoft Teams. We're using Microsoft Teams rather than Zoom as an organization, but lots of Teams meetings, lots of people like Simon recording videos for staff, lots of email. We've gone with the rule of thumb that says that you can never over communicate. So we're just communicating. And that communication comes from different levels. So that's how we've tried to allay fears. We did have some sort of staff sort of get-togethers, again, on Microsoft Teams. When we first went to remote learning, there was a sense that some were at home, very isolated. There was some staff at home with, you know, three or four small children trying to homeschool them and be a teacher. That's just impossible. So trying to just connect in with them pastorally for a chat with a cup of tea or a glass of wine at the end of the day. And we did a sort of a weekly, just a hangout, and our HR manager and I jumped online, chatted to people across the college. That then sort of died a natural death. After about 3 or 4 weeks, staff weren't wanting to connect in. I think people settled into a new rhythm, but we're talking about getting that going again this week, just as we've pivoted back. Simon, do you want to jump in? What else around the staff?
Yeah, I think one of the great learnings for me in all of this is with regard to communication is it's more important to get the decision right and have a proportional response rather than respond really, really quickly. I think sometimes there would be an announcement from, say, our premier or our health officials, and staff would almost be emailing within the next half an hour asking what's going to happen for them. And so there's obviously that temptation to quickly respond to them. But often I think we did it well in that we would meet. So there would be a considered response around all of it. And if you get the decision right, then no one looks back on how timely or not that you responded. So there was some pressure at times because our staff wanted to know things quickly, and even sometimes a couple of schools around us were ahead of us in some of their decisions. But I think because we took our time, by and large, we got most of it right, which was great. The only other thing is Emily mentioned some of the things that I did, and I did a lot of pre-recorded chats, I guess, if you like. They weren't sort of state of the nation addresses. They were really just the same things I would put in an email. And because of this, it was sort of email saturation for a lot of our staff at times. So I chose to do that. It was a bit uncomfortable to begin with, but I've got used to it now. I just record myself. I don't read a script. I just have some dot points that I go to. So it's still reasonably natural. And I try never to go past 5 minutes. And by sending out that link, it enabled our staff to watch it at their convenience because they were out of normal routine. You know, we would normally, on a Monday morning before school, gather staff, have a staff briefing. We can't do that because people were juggling their own kids at home, trying to prepare for remote learning. So sending a link and giving them sort of 24 hours to watch it actually was really effective. And I know they're going to want me to keep doing that because it actually, when we get back to, you know, our next normal, not our new normal, but I think they'll prefer that because it just gave them a bit more efficiency with their time.
So let's move on to the other group of adults. What are some lessons learned with the parents? Because I'm sure that you were receiving the emails from the teachers, the parents were like a minute ahead of them because their push alerts, they could respond quickly. So what, you know, and even with the other heads at the three levels, what are kind of some different parental things that have happened?
Yeah. Simon, do you want to start, kick off?
It's probably a similar theme, to be honest. One of the things that we, with our communication, was to make sure the timeline was accurate and we stuck to it. So our usual process would be our principal, so our head of school, would communicate to parents and staff, usually at the same time. The email would go at the same time. And then it would cascade down from there in terms of who would follow up. So that served us well because, as we know, sometimes with mobile phones and things can ping around pretty quickly. Likewise, if I had to send messages to students, if I'm speaking to students, an email would go at the same time. to their parents, so that there's no, we're really just trying to suppress some of the hysteria at times. So that's our parents, I think, because they were communicated with, as Emily said, a great deal along the way, they appreciated that. It's interesting watching what other schools do, and we all do that. I think that's important that we do that. There's a school, one of our competitors just down the road, I saw they emailed yesterday, it was the hashtag update 49. And so they've been, that's sort of the way they've been doing it. I'm not suggesting that that's right or wrong. They're just, it's an indication of how they're doing it. But they also had, they were almost sort of military in the way they were reporting. You know, when they received notification of a suspected case at 3:23 p.m. and then they did this next thing at 3:45 p.m. and heavily, heavily scripted. So that's not really our style where we are. But the communication we did, as Emily suggested, was little and often.
So what was that hashtag?
It was just an update. It was a document. It was an update. They called it hashtag update. Okay. 49, which is the 49th letter. Yeah.
What I was going to offer, Simon, is there's a couple of superintendents on the call here. We could start filling those people's Twitter pages with, what a horrible idea. You should go down the street to that better school. But we won't. We won't do that. Talk to us about. Oh, go ahead, Emily.
I was just going to say, in terms of some lessons learned from our parents, particularly across all three schools, and it will depend for your leaders here on the call, the age group, but generally, we find that the parents of young children, so our kind of three-year-olds through to our kind of, you know, eight, nine-year-olds, are often a little bit more anxious in this space. And so the way in which our head of junior school communicated with those parents was, as Simon said, it's still frequent and often, but there's a different kind of style to it, to a little bit of that communication. When you're dealing with parents of 17, 18-year-olds, they tend to just give me the details, tell me where to drop him off, and that's all I need to know. So I tended to find, looking at all three schools, that the communication was a little bit different. It's also a reflection of the school leader, and you need to feel free to communicate within your style and within the sort of the culture of the school that you've got there. We did find there are some very nervous, anxious parents who'd be on the phone a minute after every announcement. But by and large, our families really trusted us well. We tried to minimise the communication, fearing that the constant trickle, you know, with a daily email, people would just get very sick of reading it. We didn't want sort of email fatigue to set in. So what we tried to do was, again, as Simon said, we just paused on the communication. We tried to get everything that they would need into one document. We have a fairly extensive kind of 10, 11 page remote learning guide, we called it, and there's a different one for each school. So, you know, with customised information for each kind of part of our school. The other thing that document enabled us to do was ensure that there was consistency of information across all three schools. So if your leaders are in a school that has maybe a pre-K to 6 and then a 7 to 12, or you've got a middle school and a senior school, think about trying to get some consistency across all three. And that's important for us because we wanted to maintain a really strong public reputation throughout this. We wanted the brand to be consistent. We wanted the communication to look good, well thought through and well organised. And we also wanted it to look as though the three schools were talking to each other, because we have a lot of parents with children in more than one school. If we have a parent with a child in year 8 and a child in 10th grade, then they're going to be getting two different lots of communication, and we need it to look consistent. So that's something worth bearing in mind for those who might head up schools that have a diverse population.
Oh, Emily, that's a great point, because some of the people on the call have, you know, 8, 9, 3, 4 elementary schools, 2, 3 elementary, yeah, middle schools, and 2 high schools or 4 high schools. And yeah, that would create a significant issue, like you said, to those customers or parents.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so I have another question from our list here. Talk to us about absenteeism with staff. Like you said, you had talked about that was, you know, they might be caring for parents, their own children, etc. How did you handle, now I don't know the answer to this in Australia, but do you have a lot of substitute teachers?
Yes.
Oh, so we're the opposite. If we have a staff member who goes out, it's hard for us to backfill. So one of the things we really wanted to know about was, what were your absenteeism rates? How frequent were people out? How long were they out? Things like that.
Yeah. Well, look, I think the first thing to say, and then Simon can talk a bit more about his experience, but we were surprised that there were virtually no staff ringing in absent during the remote learning phase. None. And so we do have some sort of backup teachers, some substitute teachers who come in from time to time when staff are away and unwell. And we have a leave system, I think, probably similar to the US, but it's a little bit more nuanced. But our staff can take a personal leave day. Staff are entitled to 15 days per year of personal leave, and that includes sick leave, carer's leave if they have a sick child or a partner or parent or whatever. So they've got that leave there, and some staff over many years at the school have barely taken any. So they have buckets and buckets and buckets of personal leave that they can take. They're entitled to take, and other staff were already at capacity with their leave. And so it was always going to be hard for them to take weeks off. But the interesting thing is no one did. And what that was telling us is that the flexibility for them to work from home, to be at home and to teach their classes online, stopped them from taking a sick leave to stay home, taking a day of sick leave. So we had concerns and a theory that when we came back from remote learning, that there would be a massive spike in absentee because staff would be exhausted getting back to school and just thinking, oh, I just, you know, I need some time off. But that didn't seem to happen. We had a little bit of it, but not as much as we anticipated. So that was a surprise for us. The flexibility to work from home means that you just don't get people ringing in sick because they're thinking, I don't want to use up one of my leave days when I'm already at home, you know, in my slippers and dressing gown. So, it was an interesting one. Simon, would you want to add any more to that?
Only to so everything Emily said, is obviously my experience with staff. Giving staff the flexibility to work from home if they wanted to, and when I say work from home, teach from home, worked well. Just for your information, we ran a structured timetable that so students had to sign in for every lesson. There was really no flexibility for them, which made the teachers accountable. It also kept the students accountable, and that was successful for us. More recently, we've had a few issues with people doing the right thing, and that's if they had some symptoms to go and get a COVID test. And so that that turnaround time for us here was anywhere between 2 and 5 days. And so we had lots of staff, as I said, out doing the right thing, but then some of them were able to just teach from home in that phase. And we'd have another staff member would have to sit in the classroom just to make sure we had some sort of supervision there. But that became, we're a little bit nervous that the numbers were going to keep going up and we may run out of some teachers, so to speak, with all the students here. But the turnaround time allowed teachers to get back pretty quickly. I'm actually curious as to where we might end up after all of this. My crystal ball, like all of yours, is not working very well. But I think what we're going to end up with is staff who sort of are able to, if they're sick, they'll take a sick day, but then they can probably still teach from home even though they're sick. And what does that constitute a full sick day, or do we find some middle ground and suggest that maybe it's 0.5 of a sick day, and because someone else has to cover them? So there's a lot to work through there. It's not all bad. I think providing some flexibility will be good because I don't know about you, but our health officials have been stressing that, you know, gone are the days where you sort of have to suck it up or toughen up and plough on and go to school when you're not feeling well. They're now suggesting that really now you don't go to work if you're not feeling well. So a lot of people are experiencing they can work from home, but teaching is very different to most workplaces, as we know. So I'm really curious as to where we might end up.
Yeah, that is very helpful for us. I'm going to switch us to a different topic here. So when the kids were in and going back and forth and through this, how was like food handled, like the cafeteria or lunchroom, or you know, when the kids had their midday meals, How was that done? Was that traditional, or did you guys completely shift how that went?
Oh, we didn't really shift too much. We took all the cash out. There's no cash, just to stop the handling of cash. That was all just done by card, plastic cards on me. And everything, most things were packaged individually. So we don't have a cafeteria already. And I always think it's like the quintessential sort of American style cafeteria that we see in all the in the movies, where that's sort of, we're very much smaller a campus from that point of view. So we're still individually wrapped, individually packaged, and we restricted our offerings in there as well. So that's sort of how we got through that, and really encouraged the students to bring their own where they could.
We also implemented some social distancing in the sort of the canteens where the students could go and purchase food. So, we obviously mapped out the area, the total area of the space, and then figured out how many children could be in that space. That's something that we've been doing as a country anyway, just having to map out, for example, you've got to have the 2 square meters per person rule. So measure out the square meterage of the space, figure out how many people we can have in here. And that might be some advice for your other facilities at school as well, your school hall, your office, your meeting rooms and so forth. And then we had sort of signs on walls and doors around the campuses to say, this room can have 10 people in it. This room can have 5 people or 25 people in it. And the canteens were the same. So, for example, here on the senior campus, we could only have 3 children in that space. So the staff member on duty would stand at the door, open the door, and it's sort of one in, one out. As the children came in, filed past, ordered their food, paid for it, and left again. And then we implemented some things like in and outdoors. So anywhere that had 2 doorways, any room or facility in the school that has 2 doorways was marked as an indoor and an outdoor, so you don't have people crossing paths in doorways.
We also did some, we also did a lot of pre-ordering. We used an app, and so students could just pre-order. So it just creates a lot more efficiency through that space.
Was that an app through like your food service or?
Yes, it's called Skip App. I think it was, I don't know if it's a universal app, it's just the one that we happen to use. So so students and staff could just pre-order their lunch and just pick it up and go. So that was very helpful for us.
Well, that sounds fantastic. Masks. Did you guys have mandatory masks, or just because you just went to it like we did, you didn't have the experience of trying to get 4-year-olds and 5-year-olds to wear masks, or how was that?
Well, we're in the fortunate position timing-wise where masks weren't being mandated anywhere up until a week ago. So it was mandated by our state premier. So here in Victoria now, everybody, when they set foot outside their home, has to wear a mask. We didn't have that. And we're also in that climate of children not being the spreaders of the virus. So we didn't need to have masks at school. Children were invited to, were welcome to, but we didn't make it mandatory, did we, Simon?
No.
We didn't have to.
No, and Monday just gone, so Monday this week was by far my most surreal day in all of my teaching days, because that was the first day where they had mandated that from that point everyone had to wear masks. So the students, they all had them on. So in Victoria, so where we are, anyone over the age of 12 must wear a mask. And so that meant our whole campus here, we're all wearing them, and staff, and it was sort of that mixture of fun and weirdness and what are we all doing, and so even just sitting, probably the strange one for me was just a couple of little staff meetings. So there was 4 of us in a room with masks on, and it's, you sort of feel as though you don't need to wear it, but you must, and it was just bizarre. And but even just educating the students around doing that. I had some briefings with students, so we said, that you're allowed to have some personality on your mask. It can't be offensive. It can't be a huge distraction to other people. But then, I know everyone on this call will appreciate this, because we're all living in and around teenagers. At recess or morning tea, I went into the yard, and there's all the students just didn't have masks on, so I sort of put my grumpy face on and went to sort of take them on. And then I realized that they were all eating and drinking. That was and so they very quickly worked out. I have a saying that I use to do my job: you've got to think like a criminal, because you've got to think like the kids will get around anything that we put in place. And so they quickly worked out, if you have half a muesli bar in your hand or a drink, then as long as you're eating or drinking, you don't have to wear your mask. So they're very funny. They worked it out very quickly.
And there's some ways to do it with a sense of humour. I don't know if you guys have seen, going around social media, there were some funny posts around masks being just like underwear. And then it had had things like, don't touch it in public. Once it's on, you don't touch it. You don't loan yours to anyone else, you know, this kind of thing. And so those kinds of funny little tips, particularly around our middle school age kids, that, you know, that, you know, 12 and 13 year olds found that hilarious. So just trying to get some little posters up and some fun ways to kind of remind people about the importance of mask use and safety, but also to bring a sense of humour to it. So,
and interestingly, our the government regulations that we had to adhere to mandated that the teachers did not have to wear a mask in front of a class. So if you were in a teaching capacity, you could take your mask off. We offered a lot of our teachers and our non-teachers, if you like, a face shield, and lots. I didn't think many would go for it, so I'm talking about, you know, those industrial ones where it's just that clear perspex on the face. We were overwhelmed with the amount of staff who wanted one of those, which I thought was really interesting. That was one thing I didn't see coming. I didn't think they would want that, but I think a lot of them just preferred that they still wanted to feel safe when they were teaching, but they didn't like the mask. So they went with the face shield, and so that was great. We should have ordered a lot more than we did in the first round.
That's a really good tip, because that is like an hour state if you are teaching or educating, as long as you stay back 6 feet or 1.5 meters. Might be a little more than that. I think it's 2 meters for 6 feet, but I didn't do too well in my conversion classes for math, so I apologize. But that face shield piece, I'm pretty sure everybody on this Zoom wrote that down as a preference, because the masks are a little debilitating when you're trying to breathe and speak and you can't see nonverbals and things like that.
Yeah.
So Simon, this question is probably pretty good for you with your athletic background. One of the things that we're struggling with is in the United States, athletics are part of school. And I'm sure it's with you at the college. So like, you know, middle school and high school students are all at this time of the year, normally they would be getting ready for, you know, football, soccer, volleyball, running, different pieces like that. How have you guys handled athletics?
Our track and field season is coming, so we haven't had to, but we've had, so we've been in our winter sport. So it's been really complicated, and at some points it wasn't complicated because we just weren't allowed to do anything in a school sense. So we ended up, we went through periods where we were allowed to train with only 10 people in a group. Then it went to 20 people in a group. We had to wash the balls in and out of, you know, if it was a football training, then washing the balls before the training session and then on the end. So it was really more the hygiene and then being responsible around the distancing rules. But now we've swung back the other way. We're going back into lockdown, so there's no sport. We haven't had to worry about that. But that's the really confusing part for our students was here until just recently when they changed the restrictions. We had to ask them to sort of distance at school. We had to ask them to be mindful of their hygiene. Yet in the community sport on the weekends, they could play contact and collision sport. So you can imagine teenagers trying to rationalize what we're saying at school as opposed to what they can do in their own time. So that was really confusing, but that time has now passed because we've gone back into lockdown. Mm.
When you guys started, when you started transportation for athletics and for school, were there any pieces put in place for students who took busing or public transportation for distancing or masking at that time?
We asked our students to distance on buses. We have our own college buses, so that was easier. But some public buses we share, some buses with local schools, that was difficult. There was some mask wearing, but not a great deal. I meant to say before, a little tip we gave our students when they had a physical education class during the, we won't have to do this now because they've gone back into remote learning, but we weren't sure how we were going to run a practical physical education lesson during the school day when you know they were all wearing masks. So one of the things that we suggested to students was, when they take their mask off, they put it in a little Ziploc bag, and then that way they don't necessarily, it doesn't sort of sit on the bench or get thrown into a bag or can touch other things. So that was a good, nice little tip for our kids. Oh, Ted, it was just confusing. There was no real easy way to educate around that. And then that's why in some ways the restrictions just took over for us.
Mm-hmm. And as you head into, you know, the last, what do you have, 12, 13 weeks of school left for the different seasons? What are they talking about now that you're in lockdown? Did they give you like, we're going to be locked down for 2 more weeks or 1 week or indefinitely? And then are you guys planning on those different components?
Yeah, so we're locked down we're in remote learning for 6 weeks starting today. So that will take us essentially until the last week of our school term. So we're due to have a sort of a mid-semester break on the 19th of September, but this takes us until, I don't know, the 9th or the 10th of September. So we're going to get to just within a few days of the end of term. They could roll it out longer, so if the numbers don't come down here, it could roll on. But again, the kind of the dialogue coming from the experts is that this should work. And that probably within a week or two, we'll see our numbers starting to come right down. So if that happens and it goes well, it's 6 weeks. If it doesn't go well, it could be a bit longer. But then we would have a 2-week school holiday break, and then we would be back for the last kind of quarter of the year through until just before Christmas.
And then you're off from January until March, or when is your...
So we would normally break up about the 10th of December. And then we would be off for Christmas, and January is our summer season. So that's like, I think you guys have like 8 weeks or something off over summer. We only tend to have about 6 weeks off, but and then we're back kind of late January.
Oh, yeah. Sorry, we have 12 weeks off.
Oh, outrageous. 12 weeks for summer, just for summer.
Yes, yeah.
Oh, I'm in the wrong country. Who wants to offer me a job? I'm in the wrong country, clearly.
I'll give everyone your email address. You'll get one pretty quick.
We'll come over and run your schools for you. That's it. Simon and I will be there.
Ted, do you mind if I just... there's something I wanted to make sure I jumped... I popped in here at some point. We might be running out of time. And it's completely off track for what we were talking about. One of the things that we were really concerned with when we went into the first remote learning period, which for us was